it started okay?
Yeah. Third time always. First through for priming. You want to come along?
No, thanks. Got to go into town. Where are you headed?
Going out to the point.
After that big one?
Yeah. You've seen him?
Sure. Saw him after a muskrat last fall. The rat got ashore and the muskie tried to go up after him. Ran himself half aground. One big flip and he was back in before I could shoot.
That's a pretty good story, Mike. Well, see you later. If I don't bring back a fish, I'll bring back a fish story.
Going for a fish or a fish story. And his boat might be in any one of a thousand lakes with a thousand names. Oxbow, Spider, Gunlock, and Fence. Tenderfoot, Little John, and Lost Canoe. Lost Lake, Found Lake, and Bragonier. Snipe Lake, Stormy, and Lac de Lune, Cranberry, Catfish, and Scattering Rice. This is a story of lakes and the trees around them. And they are many. And the people around them. And sometimes they are many, and sometimes they are few. This is the North Country. These are the lakes, the trees, and the people of the top of Wisconsin. The Wisconsin State Broadcasting Service presents the Vilas County Profile, part 6 of a recorded experimental series entitled Wisconsin Communities. Listen to the sound profile of Vilas County, as told by the people who live there, and by Carl Schmidt, narrator-producer.
Ever tell a fish story? If you feel like telling one, Vilas County is the place. But it better be good. Dream one up and they'll come up with a better one that actually happened. Here's what I mean.
I was with two fellows on Long Lake on the what we call the Upper Eagle Chain. That's out of Three Lakes. And they had gotten disgusted with Long Lake fishing because they hadn't seen a muskie and they wanted to leave the lake. And I was very adverse to that because I don't believe in wasting time by jumping from one lake to another because it isn't apt to improve your luck and also waste fishing time. But I couldn't insist, I couldn't persuade these fellows to change their mind. And so I said, well, then we'll go into the landing. And I didn't have a motor. I was rowing across the middle of Long Lake. And I was stepping along at a pretty good rate, and I said, why don't one of you fellows drag a bait back there, both of you? I said, it isn't going to mean anything to my rowing, and you might catch a fish on the way over. And so they both did. And we were in about the middle of the lake, and I knew there weren't any weeds or anything out there. It was deep water, and one of the fellows said, I got some weeds on my line. And I said, I don't think you have. There isn't any weeds out here. Well, he said, I got something. Well, I said, reel it in. So he reeled it in, and I could see that he had an undersized muskie on his line, and it was just sliding along the top of the water, and it wasn't moving a fin. And came right in alongside of the boat, and I said, you've got an undersized muskie on there. I can see that it's a muskie, but I said, bring him right on in. He brought him alongside of the boat, and I reached over and took a hold of him by the back and back of the head, and he still didn't move, and I held him up, and he was a beautiful native muskie, and I said, gee, isn't that a beautiful fish? And well, I said, yeah, but he isn't long enough. And I said, no, he isn't. So I took the hooks out. I didn't have any difficulty at all taking the hooks out. And so I throwed him about 8 feet out in the lake, and he no more than hit the water, and he jumped back in the boat between their feet in the back end. And of course, they were pretty much scared of him, but I got back there and throwed him back in the lake again, and it was a big, heavy-set fellow in the back end of the boat, and he laughed, and he laughed, and he laughed, and he couldn't quit laughing, and he was very fleshy and red in the face, and I thought he was going to have convulsions until finally, I said, well, for heaven's sake, what's so terrible funny about that? Well, he said, you know, Stein, I've had so many of these fish stories told to me all my life, but it's the first time one ever happened to me.
Ask for the teller of that story in Eagle River, the county seat of Vilas County. His name is Pross Stein. He's been guiding fishermen for 40 years. That story of his is something like the story of Vilas County, a fish story that actually happened, and it's still happening. Of course, there's more to it than fish. People, for instance. Fish wouldn't be worth two hoots without people. But there's something else. It was here before people, and it takes more space than people. Bigger than fish, too. even bigger than the fish Tom Big John saw over on Lac du Flambeau. Tom Big John, he's the guy who can catch a muskie anytime he feels like it. But you'll meet him later. Right now, we're talking about something else.
Trout Lake.
Jute Lake Tower calling. Small white smoke at 176.
Check.
Monahan Tower.
Jute Lake sees a small white one at 176. Have a look.
Roger. Hold the line. You're right. Small white at 268.
Check. Stay with it.
Star Lake.
Bologna calling from Trout. Small white smoke half mile east of Partridge. Get on. Hold the line, Bill. Trout Lake.
Jute Lake again. Small white is getting big, brown, and ugly. Hit her hard.
Check. Bill? She's getting big and brown. Take a pump and a couple extra men.
That gives you an idea of what happens when a fire starts in a Vilas County forest. Most of the county is covered with forest, and it takes a pretty sharp organization to keep the fires down. Last year, the National Forest lost only a few over 3 acres, and the state forest less than 10. Out of hundreds of thousands of acres, that's pretty good. Two fellows responsible for that record are Will Bologna of the State Forest and Ken Elliott, National Forest. But the responsibility goes a lot farther than that. It goes right to you if you live in Vilas County, or even if you just drive through. Want to know why? Listen.
99% of our fires are man-caused fires.
And here's what to do about it.
One thing we have to be careful about, especially in the spring of the year when the vegetation is dead, these high grassed areas along the trout streams. We'd like to warn all the fishermen to be careful. And if anyone builds a campfire, we want to be sure that that's out before they leave it. Dig a good trench around it, right down to mineral soil. And if you've got a bucket or a can or anything that you can use, why, dip up enough water and round it out. Be sure that it's out to the last spark. When you're traveling along the highways in the forest, use your ashtrays. Don't toss your matches or cigarette butts out the window.
But there's more to forestry than putting out fires. Growing trees, for instance, like up at the Trout Lake Nursery. Don Mackey's in charge of the place. He has about 9 million trees, and he sends 3 million out every year to be planted. Then there's Trees for Tomorrow at Eagle River, an organization sponsored by 11 northern Wisconsin paper mills and a power company. Talk to M.N. Taylor about it. He's the director.
One of the most important phases of forestry in the state of Wisconsin is surrounded and is predicated on the planting of trees. In fact, this is the initial way and the best way to interest people in forestry.
So Trees for Tomorrow gives away trees, free for the planting. 3.5 million since 1945. That's looking ahead, but here's looking even farther.
Just yesterday at Wausau, the members of the Trees for Tomorrow Forestry Scholarship Committee interviewed and screened 14 boys from a range of 17 counties. These boys had been screened previously, and one of these boys will receive a $1,200 forestry scholarship.
Well, that takes us back a ways. We're still in the woods, but back a ways. Back when Vilas County was covered with a beautiful stand of virgin timber. They made short work of it, those lumberjacks and sawyers. They were part of a big business that went through it like a fire. Not so long ago either, plenty of people in Vilas County can tell about it.
There were at that time about 28 saloons here. And streets, of course, had wooden sidewalks, composed mostly when it rained of mud about 4 inches deep, and then dry weather of dust about 4 inches deep.
That was Ed Bradford of Eagle River. Did you get that part about wooden sidewalks? Here's another fellow who remembers them.
We had as pretty near as many sidewalks as we have now, but they were all plank. Lumber was cheap, and they planked the town in pretty good shape. I do remember that as the small boys went barefoot in the summertime, when they would come down to the store, we'd walk on the road because the sidewalk was a mass of slivers from these river drivers with their cork shoes.
Do you know who that was? Listen.
First white boy born here.
Think of it.
First white boy born here.
Paul Cook of Eagle River, only 65 years old. Yet he's the first white boy born in Vilas County. That makes Vilas pretty young from the standpoint of civilization as we know it. That doesn't leave the lumbering days very far behind. But let's get off the lumber pile now. I think it's about time for another fish story.
We had a couple fellas here from Wausau. They came late in the afternoon and were out fishing with a live sucker on a cane pole. And after dark, I heard them yelling out there, and I hollered out and asked them what the trouble was. They said, "We got a big muskie on. Will you come out and help us land it?" Well, naturally, I didn't know how big it was. I took a gaff hook and a gun along, and we got out there, and here they had it on this cane pole, and it was down on the bottom of the lake. But we finally got it up and gaffed it for them, and it was after dark, which made it quite an experience.
Well, that's a pretty good fish, but he wouldn't even make good bait for the fish Tom Big John saw over on Lac du Flambeau. You'll meet him later, Tom Big John. He's a guide, and you don't have to pay him unless you get your muskie. Something else about him. You know the minute you see him that here is a real American, although the song he sings now may be foreign to your ear.
Lac du Flambeau was not always the Chippewa country. It was occupied in the first place by the Sioux or some other tribe, and it was taken over by the Chippewas. The Chippewas originally came from the northern Canada up around the Lake Superior, and they came up here, and of course they saw the beauty of the country, the lakes, the rivers, and the chief source of living, of course, was hunting and fishing. During this time of the year, the spring of the year, they always use a torch to fish, and it was one of those such evenings where the Flambeau Lake must have been fished pretty hard by the Indians, for there were several torches on the lake when the French missionaries came up here during the evening. I suppose they came up the river, Bear River, and they saw all these torches, and they called the lake Lake of Flames, Lac du Flambeau. And other than that, it's been called by the Indians also Wasagan, which means fishing with a torch.
The legend of Waswalan, the Lake of Flames, told by George Brown, Indian official at the Lac du Flambeau Reservation. George is a short, chunky fellow, and he's a shrewd one. You've got a feeling when he looks at you that he's got you all sized up. He's got the Indian situation all sized up, and he's been the leader in making some big changes, like fish spearing, for instance.
The Indians have always had the privilege of taking a fish any time and in any manner. And it has been the practice for many years for the Indian to take fish, but spear fish, during the spawning season. This year, the tribal council, that's the governing body of the Indian or reservation, have passed an ordinance forbidding any Indian from taking any game fish out of the reservation waters during the spawning season. And it has been good so far. That is, the boys have cooperated in every way, and I think that with the help of the state in propagation, and we will have a fishing here that will not be surpassed anywhere in the state.
Better fishing will bring more tourists to the reservation. It'll give the Indians some of the same kind of bread and butter the rest of the county's getting. There'll be entertainment, too. Traditional tribal songs like the one you heard a minute ago, and Indian dances. Here's George Brown again.
It is the intention of the many organizations of the town of Flambeau to fix up the what we know as the bowl or arena to be built. That we're starting on it now, and it is the intention of the organization to put on a program every evening during the summer months when the weather is favorable. And one of those important, most important parts of this program will be the Indian dancing, the powwows, and the other Indian activities, which, after all, are the chief attractions of this North Woods. And it's going to be good because we're going to have a director who has worked with the Indians at the Dells and other places.
There are places in this world that seem to be made just for enjoyment. Look at a place like this and try to imagine a smokestack. You can't. The thing has branches on it and leaves or needles. Try to picture a guy with a lunch basket heading for an assembly line. You can't do it. That's a fishing tackle box he's carrying. He picked it up when he set down the lunch bucket. He walked from the shadow of a smokestack into the shadow of a tree. They call it recreation, recreation, making a new person out of you. That's what they do for you in Vilas County. They specialize in it. They even have a recreation zoning ordinance. Farmers are not allowed to settle in backwoods areas where the land is so poor that a valuation would not bring enough taxes to pay for upkeep on roads. Only land near main highways can be used for farming. The backwoods areas are strictly for recreation. One thing that's making recreation more and more a big business is the fact that people don't come up here to rough it very often anymore. We're all victims of civilization. Even in the North Woods, we've got to have plumbing, electricity, groceries, cocktails. Most everybody up here is concerned, directly or indirectly, with supplying these things you need on a vacation. Especially the resort owners. They have accommodations for more than 8,000 people, a number nearly equal to the total permanent population of the county. But not everybody who comes up here stays at a resort. There are the summer homes.
Everybody that comes into the area usually comes into the newspaper office and wants to know about where certain lakes are and which road to take to go such and such a place, and where to find summer home people. That's our biggest curse, because so many people have a summer home called Done Moving or Done Roving or something.
That's Joyce Larkin, editor of the Vilas County News Review. You get to know a community inside out working on a newspaper. You get to know what it has to offer, what it needs, what makes it tick. But we were talking about resorts and summer homes. Here's a theory on how one establishment grows out of the other.
In 90% of the cases, the resort industry started because somebody moved in and had a cottage on the lake and then invited their friends up. The friends brought more friends, and so they decided to build a guest cottage. And then they decided to build another guest cottage, and by this time they decided to charge. When they charged, none of their relatives and friends came, but they were in the resort business.
A change in the season means a lot more than a change in the weather to a community full of resorts and summer homes. Listen to R.J. Freilig from Hiawatha Lodge outside of Eagle River.
We live for these 2 to 3 months in the summertime. And when the middle of September comes around, why, the Northwoods goes back to really a Northwoods, and we're all alone again.
And what do you do then? Here's Glenn Roberts, a resort owner on Little Arbor Vitae.
Oh, after the fishing season is over, we start to put our boats away, and then we begin to have a little recreation ourselves. We do a little late fall fishing. Then comes a little grouse hunting and duck hunting, and then comes our muskrat trapping. Later on in the season, after the lake freezes up, we do a little perch fishing. Then comes beaver season. Then we're back on the ball again, fixing the boats for the following spring.
Speaking of late fall fishing, did you ever get a hold of a big one when you didn't have a gaff hook to land him with? Well, Glenn Roberts did, but he was lucky enough to have his wife along.
It's been more than once that she's helped me land a good-sized muskie out there. For instance, one day I hooked a nice one out there and had quite a time with him. We didn't have a gaff hook in the boat because we were out fishing really for panfish. And I did a little casting, and this muskie took on. And we had him up the boat 4 or 5 times, and we had a small landing net. We couldn't get him in the net. He was too big. So she wound the net around the hooks that were on the side of his cheek and pulled him overboard. into the boat and then sat on him.
This part of the story wasn't supposed to be about fishing at all. But when you got fellows like Prost Stein, Glenn Roberts, and Tom Big John around, you just can't get away from it. Getting back, though, to the resort business and R.J. Frelig, he's a spokesman for people who depend on tourists for their living, not only in Vilas County, but all over the state. Largely through his efforts, Wisconsin now spends $105,000 in advertising for tourists. Now, that may sound big,
but it's still low compared to other states. Now, I might add our neighbor state to the left of us, across Lake Michigan, spends $250,000 a year. I believe, rightfully, that Michigan offers less for the tourist and vacation business than Wisconsin. I know that Florida spends close to $1 million, Pennsylvania that has 50% less to offer than Wisconsin has, spends around $850,000 a year. Many other states that are in the tourist business are two and three times more on their allotment and money set aside to advertise their own recreation areas.
There's an advertising program for the whole state, and it's working. Wisconsin sells more out-of-state fishing licenses than any other state in the Union. This year should be even bigger when fishermen hear of the 10,000 muskies taken last year in Vilas County. Say, did you ever hear the one about the two fellows who got a muskie in their boat, started shooting at him, shot the bottom out of their boat? Well, we're talking about advertising now. For instance, what besides fishing could Vilas County advertise? Joyce Larkin has an idea about that.
Well, for years I have been trying very hard to get our resort people to advertise our climate. We have the ideal summer climate, warm during the day and cool at night. I have felt that we had more to sell than fishing. We have no factories, nothing to put smoke or dust in the air, and the Arizona Chamber of Commerce will please note that the ultraviolet and infrared rays of the sun come through this area with greater intensity than they do in Arizona.
Another thing besides fishing that Vilas County can rightfully boast about is scenery, especially the scenery around the world's longest chain of lakes near Eagle River. Talk to Joe Dwyer about that chain. You'll find him at the Dwyer Boat Works near Eagle River. He's a big, husky fellow with iron gray hair and a mustache to match. When he wears a red wool shirt, he looks like the cover picture of an outdoor magazine. Joe Dwyer knows boats, and he knows and loves the Eagle Chain.
It's the most beautiful chain that there is in the country.
During the summer rush season, at least 100 people a day travel through the chain for sightseeing alone. Of course, there also are those who like to mix their sightseeing with other pleasures.
Guides use it quite a bit for muskie fishing, where they have a fast motor and boat. They'll start out here and probably hit 3 or 4 nice muskie beds, and then they'll go up to the upper chain. Well, they'll go over that lift and take in probably 15 lakes on the other side, all in one day. That's why we've really worked it out so that they could get speed and get over there and cover these different muskie beds.
While Vilas County has the world's longest chain of lakes, it also has perhaps the world's shortest driver of racing speedboats. His name? Kenny Stallman. And he has a perfect right to be short because he's only 9 years old. Kenny started racing last summer.
Well, I was in about four or five races, and I got first in one, and I placed in all the rest.
And here's Kenny's description of the boat that did the work.
It was an A runabout. It was about 9 feet long, and it didn't go too fast, but and I had a 5 horsepower on it when I won.
And here are plans for the future.
I'd like to get about 7.5 Mercury, and then a better hydroplane.
Now that implies a distinct difference between a runabout and a hydroplane.
A runabout doesn't have a step in it. A hydroplane's got a step in the bottom of it.
Well, for anyone with a 9-year-old son who doesn't take kindly to conventional hobbies, there's an idea.
Thank you.
We've been talking about a few of the summer pastimes that Vilas County people are proud of, but summer is a pretty short season. What they'd probably like most of all is to get more people to go north when the sun goes south. Here's what R.J. Frelig says about the county in wintertime.
I might say this, that Northwoods, and particularly our area here with the lakes and the pines and the streams, are typical of what most people see on Christmas cards. And I always say it's a winter wonderland.
No matter how much of a winter sports enthusiast you are, chances are you've never tried a winter picnic. Probably sounds like a wild idea, until you talk with the Harvey Hazens up at Phelps. They keep their resort open 10 months a year. When the rest of the North Country is hibernating, they're out having picnics. Mrs. Hazen likes to tell about these picnics.
Winter picnics, which involves skiing across this lake, Long Lake, across a wooded stretch which has ups and downs, very interesting trail, then across Sand Lake, where we have a hunting cabin. Someone skis ahead of the crowd and builds a fire, and then the crowd joins them to have a winter picnic. We have either fried steaks or hamburgers, and it is a novelty to them. No ants, no mosquitoes to bother them, and of course the appetites are enormous. Everybody overeats, and coming back they enjoy it maybe more because of having relaxed in the meantime.
Now, many people, when they think of being outdoors in the winter, also think of being indoors with a cold. But some people who've spent winter vacations in Vilas County have other ideas.
We have had quite a few physicians and families who also said that the climate here in the wintertime is very much more beneficial to the youngsters when they get back, in as much as they build up a resistance towards colds. If they take them down to the southern climates and bring them back to strenuous cold winters in Chicago and suburbs, they are so much more apt to catch colds again.
Remember that sound? At the beginning of this program, it went out with a man on his way for a fish or a fish story. If he comes back with a fish, chances are it's a fish he helped to pay for when he bought his fishing license. Suppose it's a muskie he catches, because there's nothing he'd rather catch, the muskie being Vilas County's glamour fish. Suppose it's 30 inches long, just long enough to be legal. 5 years ago, the mother of that fish was netted out of a spawning bed, and her eggs were fertilized and placed in a big jar at the Woodruff Hatchery, just south of the Vilas County line. The egg hatches in the jar, and the small muskie bubbles over into a tank. There he lives on small organisms called zooplankton. And pretty soon he's big enough to be dumped into an outdoor pond, where he spends the summer eating small suckers. He's a vicious little fellow, that muskie. By the time he's 2 or 3 inches long, he's living on 1-inch suckers. By the end of the summer, he's 8 or 10 inches long, big enough to be planted in a lake, big enough to stay away from his grown-up relatives, who'd swallow him if they got a chance. He eats his way through a few more years, and then he's ready to give some fishermen the thrill of a lifetime.
He'll give you just about everything that you want in a fight. To begin with, he keeps you in doubt most of the time. He's following your plugs around and very often he'll follow it time after time and won't hit it. And, of course, when he hits it, then you've really got your hands full.
In fact, he's so much of a handful that the only way some fishermen can handle him is to shoot him. But here's what Glenn Roberts has to say about guns.
Well, some do it, although we don't recommend it because that way too many undersized fish might be shot and therefore they're good to no one then. We'd rather see them net them or get them without injuring them. And then if they're undersized, they can always return them to the water. However, sometimes when you get a big one, there's really no other way to handle him.
According to Pross Stein, though, who's been guiding muskie fishermen for 40 years, you won't even get the fish near a gun or a gaff hook if you don't have the right kind of rod.
Use a stiff rod. I see more mistakes made by a limber rod in fishing. I'm talking, of course, about casting, because all our muskie fishing is done by the method of casting. Now, because it's much more advantageous, you cover perhaps 10 times the area through casting that you would in trolling. And when you cast, you must set the hooks with the power in your arms and the power in your rod. And if you have a limber rod, you're just licked from the word go. You don't have a chance unless you're just lucky.
I suppose it's natural for a fisherman to talk about landing a fish before thinking of how to get him on the end of a line. Anyway, here's the question that should have come first. What do you use for bait?
Well, you know, that's very hard to say. They get them on almost everything. Some fellas swear by live suckers. Others, again, get them on river runts, head and river runts, and, well, the daredevil is a very good bait, and the Johnson Silver Minnow produces a lot of muskies.
And if you're inclined to use a plug the size of a chunk of cordwood, here's a tip that'll save a lot of work.
My best baits that I have found over all the years of my fishing are a number 6 Skinner spoon and a bucktail. The colors don't mean too much, but my pets are a red and white, even mixed color in the hair. And next to that, I would place a common jointed pikey minnow. That is in the medium size. The large baits don't mean anything for large fish. A medium-sized bait will catch you just as many fish, and large fish. I mean real big fish, as your larger baits will, and they're not near as hard to handle.
Then there's the matter of fishing secrets. Fishing secrets and Tom Big John. Here's the answer you get when you ask Indian Tom Big John, what do you use for bait?
Well, that's my business. All you bring is your rod and reel, that's all. I got the rest of it. If I tell the rest of these guys down here, they'd be out there kissing them, too. I'd run myself out of a job.
And the secret must be a good one, because here's your answer to how's fishing.
Well, it's always good to me. I can catch a muskie anytime I feel like it.
A muskie anytime he feels like it. A technique like that, whether you're talking or fishing, allows an entirely new financial arrangement between fisherman and guide. Hire Tom Big John, and if you don't catch your muskie, you don't have to pay.
I guarantee you, a fish or no pay, that's the way I fish.
Someday, when you get to know Tom Big John, he may take you out on Lake Flambeau to see the world's most gigantic muskie. Now, don't take a rod and reel along. It won't help any. Just bring an open mind, a sense of humor, and a good imagination.
We got one muskie right here in Flambeau Lake. It'd make this world's largest muskie look like a minnow. I was fishing there one day about 10 years ago, and I saw this thing coming in. The lake was kind of calm, and when I saw this thing coming, it was a great big buck. It was still in velvet horns. He got about the middle of the lake and disappeared. Didn't know where it went. And I was fishing right close to where this Medicine Rock is down there. So about half an hour, I didn't know where this fish went. And all at once, I heard a lot of commotion there near this rock over here, and that's where this muskie was. Well, he was bumping this deer's head against that Medicine Rock over there. It knocked the horns off so he could swallow it. That muskie's still there.
And that's the story of the disappearing deer and the muskie that was seen beating the deer against a rock to knock his antlers off to make for easier swallowing. That sound is for a very important fisherman, and one we haven't mentioned yet. That sound is for the fisherman who didn't catch any fish. Dozing off at night with a chorus like that in the background, he can't feel bad about a supper without fish. Or when he hears the cry of a loon from a mile away on a smooth lake, his mind wanders easily from an empty stringer. Sounds like these, as much as fish, make up the soul of a fisherman. We've been talking about the more conventional tourist attractions in Vilas County. Fishing, scenery, and, well, even winter picnics are commonplace compared to something you'll find just off Highway 51 near the western border. It concerns bullet holes and a story known to everyone old enough to read headlines during the middle 1930s. It even concerns Father Flanagan's Boys Town. It attracts at least 50,000 people every year. 1,100 cars a year ago on Memorial Day alone. Here's the story as told by Emil Winnetka. The background noise was made by logs in a 6-foot fireplace and was not intended to represent gunfire.
On April 18, 1934, a car drove into my yard. A girl and two men was in this car. They got out of the car and asked me, "How about some food? Can we get something to eat?" I says, "Yes, I'd be glad to." And after this lunch, they asked me if I had accommodations for about 10, 12 people. They told me they'd like to stay for 3 or 4 days. They played a slot machine, had a few soft drinks, didn't drink anything except soft drinks. And this is how the afternoon went on. About 5:30, two more cars drove in, a Buick and a brand-new V8 Ford. All these men had glasses on. They got out of the cars and introduced me to John and to Tom, to Pat, and they all came in, and I want to help them with the baggage. When I took the baggage out, it was awful heavy, exceptionally heavy. Something I was thinking, who could this be with this kind of a baggage? So I helped them. We took the baggage upstairs, and they asked me what they could get to eat tonight. I said, "Well, we had some very nice steaks," and they all settled for steak. After the dinner, it was about 8 o'clock, I would say, they asked me if I play cards. "But how about a little poker?" I says, "Well, this time over the year, I haven't got very much money. I still have plenty of mortgage on my place." So we played dollar limit poker, start poker. The first hand, I lost $36, and it was really a bad deal for me because at that time, $36 looked very big for me. When John reached for that money, he laughed at me. He said, "Well, just too bad. He had kings and eights, and I had kings and sixes." He reached for this money, and when his coat opened up, here I could see two automatics in his shoulder strap. Well, I got a little nervous. Who wouldn't? As I deal cards, I looked to the left, I looked to the right, and all these men were armed. Well, then I got thinking, who could this be? After all, I spent a lot of time in Chicago. I knew a lot of men of that type. So I kept on playing cards, and must have been about 10 o'clock or 10:30, they all got sleepy. Tadu Yone says, "Well, how about quitting this game? We're tired. We had a big drive." I says, "That's fine. Suits me. I got my money back. I'm very happy about that. It's perfectly all right with me." Well, everything was quiet. I was thinking, who could these men be? After I got looking through all the papers, the picture of Dillinger was in the paper every day. His height, his weight, his scars, on the scar on the forehead, his scar on the chin. Slow motion walking. He was just about my size. So I just got thinking it must be John Dillinger. So the next morning, they got about 6:30. After breakfast, I said, "John, I'd like to talk to you." He says, "Perfectly all right." Because he followed me to my law office. And I talked to him. I said, "You John Dillinger?" He says, "You're not afraid, are you?" I says, "No, I'm not afraid. You're just another man to me. But after all, every policeman in the United States is looking for you. And if I can help it, I don't want no shooting match here. Everything I made in my life is right here, and I don't want no trouble." He took it on my shoulder. And he says, "Emil, I'm tired. I'm hungry. I want to eat. I want to sleep for a few days, rest up. I pay you well, and we all get out." And from then on, we were very friendly.
But 3 days later, things started happening at a pace that left friendliness far behind. Little Bohemia Lodge went cops, robbers, and utter confusion under cover of darkness. A lumberjack driving away from the lodge with two friends was mistakenly shot to death when the noise of his car drowned out a command to halt. Dillinger, Babyface Nelson, and his friends decided to leave through an upstairs window, and they went to steal some cars. Emil Winnetka left the place, too. Let's follow him.
Firstly, myself, I went to Kearney's. Elvin Kearney was a good friend of mine. I was going to call from there. When I come there, which I would say would be about probably 45 minutes after the shooting started, Babyface Nelson was behind the door. And when I came in, he was behind the door with the 245s. I walked in, and everybody at Kearney's family was sitting down, and I said, what happened here? And then Nelson jumped out. He says, put your hands up, which I did. He says, who is outside? I says, nobody. So I says, what are you doing here with this gun? He says, these people are friends of mine. He says, you mind your own business. Get out in that car. So I went outside and thinking what just what's going to happen next minute, or half a minute, rather. He put the 45 in my ribs, and I got into the car, the Model T Ford. And I started the car, but I didn't put the switch on. He says, why don't you get this car started? You know I got to make this getaway. I says, I can. He says, you got me scared. I says, well, what's the big idea putting a gun into my ribs? What are you afraid of? Wasn't I all right the last 3 days? He says, get this car started. Push the 45 a little deeper, and actually I started the car. I just went about 10 feet when I could see the lights in my looking glass. So I slowed down, and the car came up with Carter Baum, who was Purvis's assistant from the FBI office. He says, hold with the federal officers. I stopped the car, and Nelson jumped out, and he killed him right in the seat. He shot him 8 times in his neck because he had a bulletproof wrist arm. He shot the other 2 men, Newman and Christensen, who was our constable. While he was doing this, I jumped out of this car into a pile of snow, and I lay there. Well, Nelson took the federal man's car, it was a brand new V8, left my car over there, and left. In the meantime, I ran home, which is about a mile and a half, and naturally was a lot of uproar in my yard. So they hollered at me to put my hands up, because they didn't know who I was. I just couldn't. You just tried to run a mile and a half like that's pretty hard. From then on, the shootings kept on going till about 6 in the morning. Well, that's about just about all I would say is to that, that the FBI took over, the police took over, the sheriffs were here and undersheriffs, and everybody had a gun that really was over here. So they took over, and I'm still alive and very happy to tell you about this.
Well, there's the story of public enemy number one, as he affected Vilas County. Call it tourist attraction unclassified. And when did the people start coming, Mr. Winnetka?
Well, right after that, naturally, was on the radio and it was all over in the papers, people started to come in. And finally, we got all the clothes from the government. We got the clothes here, and I got John Dillinger's father, who was a very nice man, and John Dillinger's sister here, and the old man would make a kind of a speech that crime don't pay, and the donations we used to get from this museum, as we call it, we used to send to Father Flanagan, which we still do, the Boys Town.
And in what numbers did they come?
You even can't count them. It's unbelievable.
Now near the end of our story, near the time when the fisherman returns with his fish or his fish story, let's look back over the Vilas County profile for a summary of the Vilas County character, the Vilas County attitude. It comes from three people. First, Glenn Roberts, resort owner.
One thing about this business, you get acquainted with a lot of people, swell people. We look forward to the spring because so many of them come up. We're interested in seeing them enjoy themselves because we know that they've looked forward to this vacation for a whole year. We don't want them to be disappointed. We like them to have good fishing and good weather and everything that we can do to make their vacation enjoyable. And that's true of all the resort owners up here in this neck of the woods.
Next, Walter Gander, a printer by profession who came here from England 40 years ago. This is an answer to the question, how long have you been here?
Well, I've been trying it out for the past 46 years, and I believe that I'm going to stay a little while longer.
Finally, an anecdote told by Joyce Larkin, newspaper editor.
I think perhaps maybe the best way to sum up Vilas County is the way a man summed it up when he came in the fall to change his paper. He said, I am now leaving Vilas County. I cease to live and begin to exist.
See the big fella?
Did I see him? Why, I saw the whites.
Hey, you look kind of wet. You fall in?
Fall in? Man, I jumped in. I told you I saw him, didn't I? Well, it's like this. I'm casting for hours and nothing happens. I'm reeling in fast and disgusted once when I see this thing after my plug. Biggest fish I ever saw. Scares me so I yanked the plug out of the water for fear he'll get it. Well, sir, he comes right out after it, right over the side of the boat. And I jumps out the other side. I'm not going to be in the same boat with that thing. The water brings me back to my senses, and I'm getting ready to crawl back in and tackle him when he gives one big flip and he's back in the lake. Believe me, I got back in that boat quick.
That was the Vilas County Profile, another recorded program in an experimental series entitled Wisconsin Communities. Production and narration by Carl Schmidt with technical assistance by Ben Russey. The script was written by Les Nelson. Our special thanks to Joyce Larkin for her assistance in the preparation of this program. This is the Wisconsin College of the Air.